Chapter 11. Didn't have it stripped off. That warm like chancery practice though, says you. He had by this time led us across the shop, and now opened a door in the back part of it, leading to the house entry. As he stood with his hand upon the lock, the little old lady graciously observed to him before passing out, "That will do, crook. You mean well, but are tiresome. My young friends are pressed for time. I have none to spare myself, having to attend court very soon. My young friends are the wards in Jarndyce."
"Jarndyce,"
said the old man with a start. "Jarndyce and Jarndyce. The great suit, crook," returned his lodger. "Hi," exclaimed the old man in a tone of thoughtful amazement, and with a wider stare than before. "Think of it. He seemed so rapt all in a moment, and looked so curiously at us that Richard said, 'Why, you appear to trouble yourself a good deal about the causes before your noble and learned brother, the other chancellor.'"
"Yes,"
said the old man abstractedly. "Sure. Your name now will be Richard Carstone."
"Carstone," he repeated, slowly checking off that name upon his forefinger. And each of the others he went on to mention upon a separate finger.
"Yes. There was the name of Barbary, and the name of Clare, and the name of Dedlock too, I think. He knows as much of the cause as the real salaried chancellor," said Richard, quite astonished, "to Ada and me."
"Aye,"
said the old man, coming slowly out of his abstraction.
"Yes.
Tom Jarndyce, you'll excuse me, being related. But he was never known about court by any other name, and was as well known there as she is now," nodding slightly at his lodger. "Tom Jarndyce was often in here. He got into a restless habit of strolling about when the cause was on, or expected, talking to the little shopkeepers and telling them to keep out of chancery, whatever they did. For, apostrophe says he, it's being ground to bits, in a slow mill, it's being roasted at a slow fire. It's being stung to death by single bees. It's being drowned by drops. It's going mad by grains." Apostrophe, he was as near making away with himself, just where the young lady stands, as near could be. We listened with horror. "He come in at the door," said the old man, slowly pointing an imaginary track along the shop, "on the day he did it the whole neighborhood had said 4 months before, that he would do it, of a certainty sooner or later he come in at the door that day, and walked along there, and sat himself on a bench that stood there, and asked me, you'll judge I was a mortal sight younger then, to fetch him a pint of wine. For, apostrophe says he, crook, I am much depressed. My cause is on again, and I think I'm nearer judgment than I ever was. Apostrophe, I hadn't a mind to leave him alone, and I persuaded him to go to the tavern over the way there, t'other side my lane, I mean Chancery Lane, and I followed and looked in at the window, and saw him, comfortable as I thought, in the armchair by the fire, and company with him. I hadn't hardly got back here, when I heard a shot go echoing and rattling right away into the inn. I ran out, neighbors ran out, 20 of us cried at once, 'Tom Jarndyce!'" Apostrophe, the old man stopped, looked hard at us, looked down into the lantern, blew the light out, and shut the lantern up. "We were right, I needn't tell the present hearers. Hi! To be sure, how the neighborhood poured into court that afternoon, while the cause was on. How my noble and learned brother, and all the rest of them, grubbed and muddled away as usual, and tried to look as if they hadn't heard a word of the last fact in the case, or as if they had, oh, dear me, nothing at all to do with it, if they had heard of it by any chance." Ada's color had entirely left her, and Richard was scarcely less pale. Nor could I wonder, judging even from my emotions, and I was no party in the suit, that to hearts so untried and fresh it was a shock, to come into the inheritance of a protracted misery, attended in the minds of many people with such dreadful recollections. I had another uneasiness, in the application of the painful story to the poor half-witted creature who had brought us there, but,
To my surprise, she seemed perfectly unconscious of that, and only led the way upstairs again, informing us with the toleration of a superior creature for the infirmities of a common mortal, that her landlord was a little M, you know. She lived at the top of the house, in a pretty large room, from which she had a glimpse of Lincoln's Inn Hall. This seemed to have been her principal inducement, originally, for taking up her residence there. She could look at it, she said, in the night, especially in the moonshine. Her room was clean, but very, very bare. I noticed the scantiest necessaries in the way of furniture. A few old prints from books, of chancellors and barristers, wafered against the wall, and some half-dozen reticles and workbacks, containing documents, as she informed us. There were neither coals nor ashes in the grate, and I saw no articles of clothing anywhere, nor any kind of food. Upon a shelf in an open cupboard were a plate or two, a cup or two, and so forth, but all dry and empty. There was a more affecting meaning in her pinched appearance, I thought as I looked round, than I had understood before. Extremely honored, I am sure, said our poor hostess with the greatest suavity, by this visit from the wards in Jarndyce. And very much indebted for the omen. It is a retired situation. Considering, I am limited as to situation. In consequence of the necessity of attending on the Chancellor. I have lived here many years. I pass my days in court, my evenings and my nights here. I find the nights long, for I sleep but little and think much. That is, of course, unavoidable, being in Chancery. I am sorry I cannot offer chocolate. I expect a judgment shortly, and shall then place my establishment on a superior footing. At present, I don't mind confessing to the wards in Jarndyce in strict confidence that I sometimes find it difficult to keep up a genteel appearance. I have felt the cold here. I have felt something sharper than cold. It matters very little. Pray excuse the introduction of such mean topics. She partly drew aside the curtain of the long, low garret window, and called our attention to a number of bird cages hanging there, some containing several birds. There were larks, linnets, and goldfinches, I should think at least 20. I began to keep the little creatures, she said, with an object that the wards will readily comprehend, with the intention of restoring them to liberty, when my judgment should be given. Yes. They die in prison, though. Their lives, poor silly things, are so short in comparison with Chancery proceedings that, one by one, the whole collection has died over and over again. I doubt, do you know, whether one of these, though they are all young, will live to be free. Very mortifying, is it not? Although she sometimes asked a question, she never seemed to expect a reply, but rambled on, as if she were in the habit of doing so, when no one but herself was present. Indeed, she pursued, I positively doubt sometimes, I do assure you, whether while matters are still unsettled, and the sixth or great seal still prevails, I may not one day be found lying stark and senseless here, as I have found so many birds. Richard, answering what he saw in Ada's compassionate eyes, took the opportunity of laying some money, softly and unobserved, on the chimney piece. We all drew nearer to the cages, feigning to examine the birds. I can't allow them to sing much, said the little old lady, for you'll think this curious. I find my mind confused by the idea that they are singing while I am following the arguments in court. And my mind requires to be so very clear, you know. Another time, I'll tell you their names. Not at present. On a day of such good omen, they shall sing as much as they like. In honor of youth, a smile and curtsy, hope, a smile and curtsy, and beauty, a smile and curtsy. There. We'll let in the full light. The birds began to stir and chirp. I cannot admit the air freely, said the little old lady. The room was close, and would have been the better for it, because the cat you saw downstairs, called Lady Jane, is greedy for their lives. She crouches on the parapet outside for hours and hours. I have discovered, whispering mysteriously that her natural cruelty is sharpened by a jealous fear of their regaining their liberty, in consequence of the judgment I expect being shortly given. She is sly and full of malice. I half believe, sometimes, that she is no cat, but the wolf of the old saying. It is so very difficult to keep her from the door. Some neighboring bells, reminding the poor soul that it was 9:30, did more for us in the way of bringing our visit to an end than we could easily have done for ourselves. She hurriedly took up her little bag of documents, which she had laid upon the table on coming in, and asked if we were also going into court. On our answering no, and that we would on no account detain her, she opened the door to attend us downstairs. With such an omen, it is even more necessary than usual that I should be there before the Chancellor comes in, said she, for he might mention my case the first thing. I have a presentiment that he will mention it the first thing this morning. She stopped to tell us in a whisper as we were going down that the whole house was filled with strange lumber which her landlord had bought piecemeal and had no wish to sell, in consequence of being a little em. This was on the first floor. But she had made a previous stoppage on the second floor, and had silently pointed at a dark door there. The only other lodger, she now whispered in explanation, a law writer. The children in the lanes here say he has sold himself to the devil. I don't know what he can have done with the money. Hush! She appeared to mistrust that the lodger might hear her even there, and repeating, hush! Went before us on tiptoe, as though even the sound of her footsteps might reveal to him what she had said. Passing through the shop on our way out, as we had passed through it on our way in, we found the old man storing a quantity of packets of waste paper in a kind of well in the floor. He seemed to be working hard, with the perspiration standing on his forehead, and had a piece of chalk by him, with which, as he put each separate package or bundle down, he made a crooked mark on the paneling of the wall. Richard and Ada, and Miss Jellyby, and the little old lady had gone by him, and I was going when he touched me on the arm to stay me, and chalked the letter J upon the wall in a very curious manner, beginning with the end of the letter and shaping it backward. It was a capital letter, not a printed one, but just such a letter as any clerk in Messrs. Kenge and Carboy's office would have made. Can you read it? He asked me with a keen glance. Surely, said one. It's very plain. What is it? J. With another glance at me, and a glance at the door, he rubbed it out, and turned an A in its place, not a capital letter this time, and said, what's that? I told him. He then rubbed that out, and turned the letter R, and asked me the same question. He went on quickly until he had formed in the same curious manner, beginning at the ends and bottoms of the letters, the word Jarndyce, without once leaving two letters on the wall together. What does that spell? He asked me. When I told him, he laughed. In the same odd way, yet with the same rapidity, he then produced singly, and rubbed out singly, the letters forming the words Bleak House. These, in some astonishment, I also read. And he laughed again. Hi, said the old man, laying aside the chalk. I have a turn for copying from memory, you see, miss, though I can neither read nor write. He looked so disagreeable, and his cat looked so wickedly at me, as if I were a blood relation of the birds upstairs, that I was quite relieved by Richard's appearing at the door and saying, Miss Summerson, I hope you are not bargaining for the sale of your hair. Don't be tempted. Three sacks below are quite enough for Mr. Crook. I lost no time in wishing Mr. Crook good morning and joining my friends outside, where we parted with the little old lady, who gave us her blessing with great ceremony, and renewed her assurance of yesterday in reference to her intention of settling estates on Ada and me. Before we finally turned out of those lanes, we looked back, and saw Mr. Crook standing at his shop door, in his spectacles, looking after us, with his cat upon his shoulder, and her tail sticking up on one side of his hairy cap like a tall feather. Quite an adventure for a morning in London, said Richard with a sigh. Ah, cousin, cousin, it's a weary word, this chancery.
It is to me, and has been ever since I can remember, returned Ada.
I am grieved that I should be the enemy, as I suppose I am of a great number of relations and others,
and that they should be my enemies, as I suppose they are, and that we should all be ruining one another without knowing how or why, and be in constant doubt and discord all our lives.
It seems very strange, as there must be right somewhere, that an honest judge in real earnest has not been able to find out through all these years where it is.
Ah, cousin, said Richard. Strange, indeed. All this wasteful, wanton chess playing is very strange. To see that composed court yesterday jogging on so serenely, and to think of the wretchedness of the pieces on the board, gave me the headache and the heartache both together. My head ached with wondering how it happened, if men were neither fools nor rascals, and my heart ached to think they could possibly be either. But at all events, Ada, I may call you Ada?
Of course you may, cousin Richard.
At all events, chancery will work none of its bad influences on us. We have happily been brought together, thanks to our good kinsmen, and it can't divide us now.
Never, I hope, cousin Richard, said Ada gently.
Miss Jellyby gave my arm a squeeze and me a very significant look. I smiled in return, and we made the rest of the way back very pleasantly. In half an hour after our arrival, Mrs. Jellyby appeared, and in the course of an hour the various things necessary for breakfast straggled one by one into the dining room. I do not doubt that Mrs. Jellyby had gone to bed and got up in the usual manner, but she presented no appearance of having changed her dress. She was Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.